Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The senators and Judge Sonia Sotomayor took their seats on Capitol Hill again this morning for day three of her confirmation hearings. Texas Republican John Cornyn kicked off the proceedings.
I appreciate the good humor and attitude that you brought to this, and I very much appreciate your willingness to serve on the highest court in the land.
It hasn't all been so courtly, though the likely outcome is clear. Unless you have a complete meltdown, you're going to get confirmed, South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham said on Monday. And that has looked like the path she's on. But the questions keep coming as Judge Sotomayor works her way toward the United States Supreme Court. Today, we'll look at what we have and have not learned. This hour, On Point, judging Judge Sotomayor and what she might mean for the nation's high court. You can join the conversation. What do you make of Judge Sotomayor's performance this week in confirmation hearings? Are you satisfied on the wise Latina front, the empathy front? Are you rooting for or against a Justice Sotomayor? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington, from the Senate's Hart Building, where the hearings are being held, is Dahlia Lithwick, terrific legal affairs analyst and senior editor at Slate. Dahlia, thanks so much for being here.
Hi there, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you predicted right off the bat that we would have a carnival of unanswerable questions and a blizzard of formulaic denials. Is that what we've got?
I think so. I think it's been hundreds and hundreds of reporters watching paint dry. There's not much news coming out of these hearings. What we're seeing is very, very scripted senators talking to their base and the nominee answering really as little as she can and really also, I think, toning down everything so that it almost comes out in this flat, monotonous, I am anything but a temperamental, fiery, crazy judge tone. And so it makes for pretty boring TV.
We went in with some big questions that had been pumped up out of speeches that she'd made, the wise Latina quote above all, where she'd said she'd hoped that a wise Latina woman, you know, would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life. Here's Lindsey Graham responding to that on Monday, saying, if it had been me.
This wise Latino comment has been talked about a lot, but I can just tell you one thing. If I'd said anything remotely like that, my career would have been over.
So his would have been over. Hers apparently is not. And Dahlia, I wanted to get your take on what she has said about it. She called it a rhetorical flourish off of an earlier statement by Sandra Day O'Connor that a wise old man and a wise old woman should be able to reach the same conclusion. Here's Sotomayor.
I was using a rhetorical flourish that fell flat. I was trying to play on her words. My play fell flat. It was bad because it left an impression that I believed that life experiences commanded a result in a case, but that's clearly not what I do as a judge.
So what about this one, Dahlia? How is she dealing with it? Is it a problem for her or has she moved past it somehow?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, every single one of the Republicans on the committee to have questioned her so far, with the exception, I think, of Chuck Grassley, I don't think he invoked it, has really spent a lot of time on this. This is clearly the centerpiece of the confirmation. And one of the things that comes up is, and Senator Cornyn did it in his initial speech this morning, was, I think this is a better way of knowing who you are than your 17-year judicial record, which I pretty much find unobjectionable. So it's being held out by her questioners as, this is the real you. Explain the real you to me, because everything else is smoke and mirror. So it's being invoked really quite a lot. And as you noted, yesterday when she talked, she said it was a failed rhetorical flourish. She said at one point the words didn't make sense. She said it was a bad idea. I will say that in her colloquy with Cornyn this morning, she has pushed back a little. She's a little bit less apologetic. She really said, look, I still stand by the idea of the words in that speech. The word choice fell flat. She had a slightly confusing little riff where she said my words were different than I understand my words to have been understood. So what I think she's doing now is appropriating the basic idea of that speech, which was, look, women and men and people of different experiences have different experiences that colors who they are. It may or may not affect how they think, but when it comes time to apply the law, I do it in a dispassionate, mechanical way. So she's got a defense of it, but today she's a little bit less inclined to apologize. She's apologizing for how it was perceived more than apologizing for what she said. So it's interesting. I'm not sure she's quite as willing to sort of eat crow on this, but, you know, maybe that'll change over the course of the day.
She said today, this morning, in response to Republican Senator John Cornyn, I stand by the words, but then she elaborated this way.
We rely on the law to command the results in the case. So when one talks about life experiences, and even in the context of my speech, my message was different than I understand my words have been understood by some.
Okay, parse that. Dahlia, one of the arguments being made by Republicans here is that we're not getting the real Sonia Sotomayor, that this is it always happens, but this is a very boxed up version for the hearings, and something else will emerge on the high court bench if and when she's confirmed there. What do you say to that?
Well, that, as you said, that always happens. You know, we always see a very, very carefully coached and packaged nominee, and we always see them answer, you know, the formula is you answer just enough to get confirmed and nothing more. I think we're seeing it more acutely this time around because of the attacks on her. The attacks have always been she's a bully, she's got a temperament problem, she's excitable, she's, you know, over the top. And even, I think, all the efforts by her supporters in the last couple of months to humanize her and make her warm and personable, it's fallen into this trap of she's emotional, she's empathetic. So what we really are seeing, I think, more so in this confirmation than any I've seen before, is someone who's almost forced into the position of making themselves smaller and more unobjectionable than they already are. So that the Sotomayor, both for good and for bad, that we've heard about coming into these hearings, both that she's temperamental, she's inclined to lose it, that she's emotional, that's not here. But we're also not really seeing what the Democrats had touted as someone who's very warm, very gregarious. That part is gone, too. This is a very, very careful on the law. She is very, very meticulous. Nobody, I think, disputes that when she talks about cases, she's extremely smart. But she does look a little bit like a microchip as compared to what all of us thought we were going to get.
This issue of the heart came up on Tuesday. Republican Senator John Kyle asked her about a metaphor that then-Senator Obama had used in 2005 when he explained his vote against John Roberts. At the time, he compared a judicial decision to running a marathon. Here's Kyle and Sotomayor.
Do you agree with them that the law only takes you the first 25 miles of the marathon and that that last mile has to be decided by what's in the judge's heart?
No, sir. That's I wouldn't approach the issue of judging in the way the president does. He has to explain what he meant by judging. I can only explain what I think judges should do, which is judges can't rely on what's in their heart. They don't determine the law. Congress makes the laws. The job of a judge is to apply the law. And so it's not the heart that compels conclusions in cases. It's the law. The judge applies the law to the facts before that judge.
Appreciate that.
Appreciate that, says Senator Kyle. Dahlia Lithwick, I mean, it's hard to argue with that depiction, but it all, you know, many thought that Barack Obama indeed wanted somebody with a little heart, maybe even a particular kind of heart here in this nomination.
I think that's right. And I think what that highlights is the extent to which conservatives have really won the war of messaging. When it comes to confirmation hearings, there's no longer any dispute that what you want is John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts' metaphor of balls and strikes, neutral umpire, who just calls them like they see them. I will say, Tom, one of the very interesting subtexts of the hearing is watching the Democrats struggle with that, because some of the Democrats on the committee are doing exactly that. They're calling her a neutral umpire, John Roberts in a leg cast. You know, this is absolutely someone who just neutrally applies the facts. But there are others, notably Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island, who really have embraced Obama's empathy principle, who do say there's something missing from the Roberts formulation. The Roberts court is heartless, and that when Sotomayor comes and brings to the table an understanding of the real world, what it's like to wait on the phone when your house is in foreclosure and you can't put food on the table, Whitehouse said, you know, if she brings that to the table, she doesn't have to apologize for that. So I think there's a very, very interesting moment going on where the liberals on the committee, who dominate the committee by numbers, still haven't quite figured out whether they want to embrace this empathy heart principle or run screaming from it. And I think that as a consequence, Judge Sotomayor both embraces the idea that she has empathy. She says, look, Alito said at his confirmation hearings that he looks at immigration cases differently because his family were immigrants. Mm. That's all I'm saying. But at the same time, she says, but I just call balls and strikes. So there's a little schizophrenia at work here.
Dahlia, where do you see these hearings going? And if it's a thumbs up, as most people expect, in a word, what does it mean for the court?
Well, I think it's going to be I think she's going to be confirmed without a problem. I think even her detractors, many of them will vote for her. And in a word, I think what she does bring to the court is what Obama originally meant when he talked about empathy. A little bit more understanding of what life is like on the ground, what it's like to grow up poor, what it's like to ride the Greyhound bus. I think she's going to have some stories to tell. And we know this about the court. Those stories make a huge difference. So I think she's going to bring just a new perspective and a very, very historic and interesting perspective that will shape the court, maybe not so much on these 5-4 tight cases, but just in terms of the court telling a slightly different story.
Dahlia Lithwick, legal affairs commentator for Slate.com. Dahlia, thank you very much for being here from Capitol Hill.
It's always a pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the judgment of Sonia Sotomayor, the Supreme Court nominee now before the U.S. Senate, and what she might mean for the nation's high court. In his opening statement to the hearings on Monday, Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy spoke in glowing terms of Judge Sotomayor's experience and qualifications.
She has more federal court judicial experience than any nominee to the United States Supreme Court in nearly 100 years. She is the first nominee in well over a century to be nominated to 3 different federal judgeships by 3 different presidents. She is the first nominee in 50 years to be nominated to the Supreme Court after serving as both a federal trial judge and a federal appellate judge. She will be the only current Supreme Court justice to have served as a trial judge.
How's that for a resume, says the Democratic chairman of the committee now examining Judge Sotomayor. At the same hearings, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham was blunt about her likelihood of being confirmed.
Unless you have a complete meltdown, you're going to get confirmed. And I don't think you will, but, you know, the drama that's being created here is interesting. And my Republican colleagues who vote against you, I assure you, could vote for a Hispanic nominee. They just feel unnerved by your speeches and by some of the things that you've said and some of your cases.
There's Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. We have a supporter of the nomination and an opponent with us this hour. First, from New Haven, Connecticut, we're joined by Stephen Carter, professor of law at Yale Law School, clerk for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. He and Judge Sotomayor, or then student, were members of the class of 79 at Yale Law School. He edited her paper for the Yale Law Journal. He's also a best-selling novelist. His latest novel, Jericho's Fall, has just been published. Stephen Carter, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Washington is Wendy Long. She's been attending the confirmation hearings this week, twittering and blogging from the hearing room. She's legal counsel to the Judicial Confirmation Network, an organization opposed to the Sotomayor nomination. She was a law clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, a litigation partner, editor of the Northwestern University Law Review, graduate cum laude there. Wendy Long, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Wendy, you're on the record against the nomination. What are you seeing so far on Capitol Hill?
Well, you know, it's interesting, but I find myself in agreement with a liberal law professor I'm doing an online debate with, Mike Seidman from Georgetown, who, like Stephen, clerked for Thurgood Marshall. But what Mike said yesterday was he concluded he was disgusted by her testimony, is the word he used, and I said, I'm disgusted, too. And I agree with him that if she is not perjuring herself, I think she's intellectually unqualified to sit on the Supreme Court. It's been thoroughly disgusting. Dahlia called it boring, but I think it's been evasive. I think she hasn't had the courage to stand up for her view of constitutional interpretation, and I think it's not serving the American people very well.
You're going to have to explain what's disgusting and what you mean by perjury here.
Well, she has answered questions in a way that are flatly inconsistent with the last 30 years, not only of her law review articles and speeches, but with the decisions she's made. You know, every time she's challenged, she gives these, you know, rote, formulaic answers that are, you know, I believe in fidelity to the law. I believe in applying the law to the facts. And she doesn't say anything more. She refuses to defend the things that she has clearly said, and in some cases, she's just run away from them.
Isn't that what nominees do sitting before this committee? I mean, isn't that sort of the formula lately? You know, say as little as possible, duck and cover, and scoot onto the court.
No, Tom, you're exactly right. That ever since Judge Bork, and Dahlia was right, there has been a tendency to try to say as little as possible and to try not to say things that are extremely controversial. You're right that far. But if you look back at John Roberts' testimony or Stephen Breyer's testimony or anybody, it doesn't even come close to the non-answers that we're getting from Judge Sotomayor, and particularly because of the contrast, because she has been so far out there and so strong in advocating the view that things external to the written law or the history or the principles of the law, things that are sort of internal to the judge, are appropriate as a basis for deciding cases. And that's a respectable point of view. It's got a long history. It's sort of the view that Justice William Brennan articulated of the living Constitution. And there are two schools of thought about constitutional interpretation. I think that it's a valid debate. It's a debate worth having. I think John Roberts served that debate. I think Stephen Breyer served that debate. I don't think this serves the debate.
You say she's ducking it. Stephen Carter, Sonia Sotomayor is an old friend of yours, but you're on the record supporting her on her merits. There's a pretty strong opening salvo from Wendy, you know, almost charging perjury here, or at least a big inconsistency. Do you see it?
That's the kind of rhetoric that we tend to hear in confirmation fights by opponents, and it's true whether it's on the right or the left. It's not that big a deal. It happens all the time, and I did read the online debate. I've been following that. It's been very interesting. I did read Mike Seidman's comments. They're very colorful, as Wendy's this morning are very colorful, and they're mistaken. They're mistaken on a couple of grounds. First thing is, I study the confirmation process professionally. I've written a book about it. I've written dozens and dozens of law review articles about it. And the fact is that what Wendy's describing as a flight from the record is what virtually every single nominee who's ever testified, with the exception of Judge Bork, has been accused of doing, sometimes in enormous heat. Clarence Thomas was accused of it. Thurgood Marshall was accused of it. Stephen Breyer was accused of it. Judge Ginsburg was accused of it. Even William Brennan, who was mentioned a moment ago, was accused of it in his confirmation hearing back in the 1950s. It's an accusation that comes up all the time, and it comes up for a very simple reason, that everyone who sits before that committee knows there is absolutely nothing to be gained by defending your record or engaging on your views in detail. What you mentioned a moment ago, Justice Breyer's confirmation hearings, what's interesting about Justice Breyer's confirmation hearings is there's a brief spurt where he talks broadly about constitutional philosophy, and then he backs off an instant later. Well, it was probably an hour later, but never comes back to it again and never will engage in it again. The same thing happens with Ginsburg. Most judges never even started on the brief spurt. I actually agree with something that Dahlia Lithwick said. I do think that the conservatives have won the war of ideas about the Supreme Court in that sense, that in the popular mind, even though we have this absurd system where we take public opinion surveys on whether people agree or disagree with court decisions they've never read, dealing with parts of the Constitution they are unaware of, that people want to believe deeply. There's something in the American ethos that makes people want to believe that the courts are different from other branches of government, that they are not out there legislating, that somehow they're just doing law. And the burden of Mike Seidman's comments that Wendy referred to was that nobody in academia believes judges just do law, whatever that means, but that's the public perception. And in the end, every nominee to the court paints himself or herself that way, because every nominee to the court understands that is how you avoid trouble.
Let's go to a conservative on the panel. This was Monday, in Alabama Republican Senator Jeff Sessions. And I wonder how you respond to this, Stephen Carter. He said the American judiciary system was facing a crossroads, down one path, you know, impartial system of law, down the other, judicial activism.
Down the other path lies a brave new world where words have no true meaning and judges are free to decide what facts they choose to see. In this world, a judge is free to push his or her own political or social agenda. I reject that view, and Americans reject that view.
Stephen Carter, is that what's on the line here?
I don't think so, although I understand the concern in a general way. There's a lot of political science that tells us that the kind of opinions someone is likely to write in the Supreme Court are the kinds of opinions that person wrote in the Court of Appeals. One of the reasons that I support Judge Sotomayor so strongly, and I have had other people I know well who have been nominated to the Supreme Court where I've kept silent. Let me just say that. One of the reasons I support her so strongly is because she writes, for the most part, really, really outstanding opinions. What I like about her opinions, and this is a response to what the senator was just saying, is that she delves deeply into both parties' arguments. She has a tendency, far more than most appellate judges and, frankly, more than most people currently sitting on the Supreme Court, she has a tendency to try to lay out the argument she's going to disagree with as fairly and as much detail as possible. No judge always writes that way, but she writes that way more than most Court of Appeals judges do, and that gives me a lot of confidence. The other thing gives me a lot of confidence is, you know, I said I knew her when she was a law student. I've known her a long time. I edited her student note for the Yale Law Journal. And what I saw as a law student is when she was a law student, is what I also see now. She's someone whose love affair is with the law itself. She's not a judge out there on a mission. No matter what one may see in her speeches, you've got to look at her opinions. You can't find in her opinions someone who has this radical vision of changing America. There are people who have that radical vision, and some of them have made it to the court. But she's not that person. She, I think, is the person that her opinions tell us, and she's written an awful lot of them, nearly 400. And if you look at those opinions, you find someone who is determined to get the law right. Does she get it right all the time? I don't think so. Mm. I don't think anybody does. I know I don't. But the law itself is a muse for her in a way that I think it's not for a lot of judges.
Stephen Carter, Wendy Long, stand by. We've got a lot of comments and questions from our listeners in Antwerp, New York. Nick, you're on the air.
Yep.
Hi, Nick. What do you see? Hello,
well,
Nick. You're on.
Okay. I just find it unusual that the white male perspective is taken as normal. What's wrong with having a white Latina woman on the court? Do they all have to be white males? You know, it's like this firefighter's case. Okay, excluded all the black people and all the Spanish people. So everyone's against it because they don't want affirmative action. Well, suppose you look at it as affirmative action for white people, that test, you know.
What's wrong with a wise Latino on the court, you say? And we've got it, Nick. Let me get one more right here from Boston. Cicely, you're on the air.
Well, thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
This is sort of relates to that. I just think that all the decisions that the justices make on the bench draw on life experience. It's a fiction that there's some sort of objective point of view, and the conservatives attacking this nomination are covering up the fact that ideology and morality and personal beliefs do underlie all decisions. And so the real question is, given that that's just so, are we going to have diverse people making decisions for, you know, America, which is a diverse nation? Are we going to reflect that and not pretend that, you know, the white male perspective is somehow neutral and objective and the rule of law, and when it very often favors the people in power?
Cecily, we've got it, and it's well put. Wendy Long, what do you say to our two callers?
Well, to Nick, I would say, and I've said this before, I'd be thrilled if there were 9 Latino women on the court. That's not the issue to me. I'd be thrilled if there were 9 black men on the court. The issue is the commitment of the judge to be faithful to the Constitution and not to apply his or her own views. And I disagree with Cecily that it's a fiction that there's an objective point of view. I think there absolutely is. And when I clerked for Justice Thomas, he would always tell us, okay, let's flip this around, you know, let's flip our reasoning around and pretend that the outcome is serving the party that we don't think we're sympathetic to, and does the law work? And we're always testing things that way. So I think it really is a valid debate as to whether you're following what is outside, external to the judge, in the law, not necessarily in the text of the Constitution. I agree it's not always clear there, but beyond that, where do you go? Do you dig into history and the principle, or do you look into your own heart, what's inside the judge herself? So I think it's a valid debate. I think one is trying to be objective, and the other is foregoing any attempt to be objective.
Stephen Carter, what do you say on this front? There's been a lot of conservative assertion that, well, you know, she's playing it straight and narrow in the hearings, but if you look at her record, once she's on the court, once she's making precedent instead of governed by it, you know, she'll be wild and crazy, Sonia Sotomayor.
Well, I think, especially thinking about what Wendy just said, I want to divide Wendy's comment into 2 points. Early in her last answer, she said that there is an objective point of view, and at the end she said we need to try to find it. And I think it's that second point that's correct. I don't know what an objective view of the Constitution would look like. I do know that it's important for judges to be aware of their biases and to try their best to screen them out. But the greatest judge of the 20th century, at least in my view, Benjamin Cardozo, pointed out in his book on the judicial process that everyone who is a judge is a combination of all of the experiences that he or she has had in life. And no matter how you try to screen them out, they will always have some bearing on your decision. So I agree partly with the caller. You can't entirely eliminate it. But I do think it's important to have as judges people who recognize the danger of bias, the danger that they'll end up on a mission, and who try to avoid it. And I genuinely believe, contrary to what I know Wendy believes, I genuinely believe that Judge Sotomayor falls into that category, that she recognizes the danger. And if you look at her opinions, you simply cannot find, I think, the evidence that this is someone who is consulting her heart and her morality and trying to twist the law to fit her view of the outcome.
So do you see Judge Sotomayor, you know, biting her tongue this week in these hearings, chafing, unable to sort of let her intellectual horses loose here, or something else?
Well, I wouldn't know if she's – I don't know if she's biting her tongue or not. I do think she's doing what the other nominees do. She is trying very hard not to say anything of substance, because if you say anything of substance, no matter how small, that is the little clip that will run in every talk show and on every cable show forever. And so you try to be as bland as possible. You do paint yourself beige. That's what nominees do. I am on record as believing the nominee should not appear before the Senate. The nominee did not appear until the 1950s. Having the nominee appear was a device invented by the Dixiecrats to try to overturn Brown against the Board of Education. Before that, it was widely believed that it was beyond the constitutional authority of the Senate to have the nominee appear, and I think that is actually would have been a better system. And we see that, because what happens is the nominee sits there, the senators ask these very long questions. And some of them are very thoughtful questions, but they're largely playing to the home crowd. And this is true with Democrats and Republicans alike. And we all know the nominee is not going to answer. The nominee is going to duck and weave and maybe tease us with an answer a little bit, but never give a detailed response. And that is the system that we have.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the hearings on the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor to the U.S. Supreme Court, going on right now in the U.S. Senate in Washington, and what a Justice Sotomayor would mean for the nation's high court. Stephen Carter is with us, Yale Law School, author of the new novel Jericho's Fall, classmate, class of 79 at Yale Law School, with Sonia Sotomayor. He clerked for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. From Washington, we're joined by Wendy Long, legal counsel at the Judicial Confirmation Network. They're opposing the nomination. She clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Let's go to Buffalo, New York, and Paul. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad I am not watching the hearings because this talk of race is quite mind-numbing with these white senators. My question to your panel is anybody or has anybody asked Sotomayor about her views on executive power and privilege? We have a president now who is making a huge power grab, more so than even George Bush did, with a suspension of habeas corpus rights to certain detainees in Bagram and other places, an indefinite detention policy, and even in a specific case of the Uyghurs, which have been jailed at Guantanamo for over, 7 years now, our own State Department saying that they do not pose a threat to the United States, and they still maintain imprisonment in Guantanamo. And the president
free now in Bermuda, I think, but they were there a long time. But executive powers have your attention. Wendy Long, I'll go first to you on that. I haven't seen every minute of this. Has she been pressed on executive powers? Has a Sotomayor view emerged?
No, she was. Somebody started down that line yesterday, and I got diverted. I do remember whichever senator it was who was questioning her got her to say she had to think carefully about whether it was after she was asked on one occasion about 9/11 and what a tragedy it was and so forth. She went through that several times, and then the senator pressed her and said, "Do you think that the folks behind 9/11 are out there plotting and planning and trying to destroy us?" And she had to think for a minute, but she finally assented to that view, which I thought was a little bit of a victory for the senator. And I think they tried to go down that road, but I don't think they certainly got into her views too much on executive power.
There was one exchange that probably bears on this on yesterday. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold was asking about the 1944 Supreme Court case Korematsu versus United States. That's the case that ruled the executive order to round up Japanese Americans into internment camps during World War II did not violate the Constitution. Here's Feingold's question and the nominee's response.
I asked Chief Justice Roberts about this. I'll ask you as well. Do you believe that Korematsu was wrongly decided?
Was, sir.
Does a judge have a duty to resist the kind of wartime fears that people understandably felt during World War II, which likely played a role in the 1944 Korematsu decision?
A judge should never rule from fear. A judge should rule from law and the Constitution. It is inconceivable to me today that a decision permitting the detention arrest of an individual solely on the basis of their race would be considered appropriate by our government.
Judge Sotomayor yesterday. Stephen Carter, there's an example of the nation, the executive responding in crisis, maybe in fear. She said a judge should never rule from fear. It sounds relevant to the post 9/11 issues of executive power. What have you seen in her testimony, in her background on this front?
Well, she hasn't had to hand down a lot of decisions about separation of powers and that aspect of constitutional law. There has been a growing trend in the courts until fairly recently, actually, to defer more and more to the executive. Power has been being centered in the executive for the last 50 years. The trend that the caller mentioned is a real trend, and it is true that President Bush gathered a lot of executive power. It is true that President Obama is gathering even more executive power. Felix Frankfurter wrote a long time ago that the ultimate security against that is not the courts, but the common sense of the American people. That is, I think people have to decide how much power they want the executive to have. Frankfurter's point is not much a court can do about it because in the long run, not everything is litigated. Power flows where it's going to be used, and people just have to decide how powerful a Congress they want and how powerful a president they want.
But when she looks at President Obama, our caller mentioned, when she looks back on George W. Bush, do you see a readiness? Would you anticipate a readiness to somehow enter the fray on these very important issues differently than we've seen so far?
I'm sorry. I should have finished my point. I don't think that we have a lot of guiding precedent from her. What I meant to say was that the precedent on the court for a long time was strongly in favor of executive power. In the last couple of years, it's cut back a little bit, but I think not all that much. Without knowing her views, I would guess that she would be in the mainstream of these issues.
When she says a judge should never rule from fear, that might suggest to some ears that fear has been used by the executive to push through things that perhaps a judge, you know, would resist.
I don't think we should try to read too much into that answer. I think she was responding to Senator Feingold's use of the word fear in his question. What I would say is this: I do think that Judge Sotomayor, the Judge Sotomayor that I've seen in her decisions in the Second Circuit, would not be swayed in her decision making about what was an appropriate exercise of executive power by, say, whether it was popular or not, or whether the president was popular or not, or what her own views were on, say, a war or anything else. She would try, I think, to do exactly what Wendy Long described. She would try to find the sources of law that didn't necessarily represent the result she already wanted to reach.
Let's go to Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on the air.
A pleasure, Tom. Steve Carter, pleasure to speak to you both. My point that I wanted to make is that Sonia Sotomayor has passed the litmus test for liberal values in this country, and that what's important is she will always rule in favor of undocumented alien rights, giving them constitutional protection under the law in the United States. And this dovetails into health care, into a tax revenue stream and everything. We have close to probably 15 million people living in this country that have cloudy rights in this country, and it should be clarified. And Sotomayor will be instrumental in clarifying this, and I think she will always rule in favor of undocumented worker and alien rights.
I don't know if that's true, but would you support that, Alan, if she did? I have no idea if she would, but would you support that?
I mean, let's get real here. Everybody has people that are undocumented working in their midst. This has to be resolved. We can't have this cloudy situation. It's creating animosity with people that are against the rights. And once they're given these rights, the road to citizenship is open. And I think we'll be more diverse and accepting society as a result. We can't have two tiers of persons living in this country. Mm-hmm. There has to be one class of rights available for all.
Alan, let us pick it up. Wendy Long, what have you heard in the hearings? What do you know about Sonia Sotomayor on this front, the rights of undocumented immigrants?
Well, I don't think we know too much about that, and particularly in her role on the Second Circuit. You know, she's ruled in there. I think it's been discussed, lots of immigration cases, but they're pretty unremarkable, and she hasn't had that much discretion in this regard when she's ruling on those cases. But getting back to just her opinions sort of globally and to follow up on points Stephen was making, I have a very, very different view of the opinion she's written on the Second Circuit. I think that what they display is, in difficult cases, which are a very small percentage of the cases, as the president has said, I think everyone agrees, what I've seen is opinions that really avoid grappling with the important legal issues, like in the Ricci case. I mean, I think what she has done, putting substance
aside, New Haven firefighter.
Mm-hmm. Putting substance aside, what I have seen is someone who appears to be either fearful or to lack the intellectual firepower to deal with, to really grapple with the precedents at issue. And I'd give you as an example, not only the Ricci case, where she tried to dispose of an important case that raised unanswered questions by a summary order, an unpublished opinion that doesn't grapple with the precedents, doesn't apply the law, doesn't do exactly what she has said she does. The other example is on the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. In those cases, a very short per curiam opinion that ignored 100 years of incorporation doctrine. That's the judicial doctrine by which the Bill of Rights is applied to the states. And then when she was asked about it yesterday by Senator Hatch, she had this confused look on her face, and I don't know whether she absolutely didn't understand these two lines of cases under the Privileges and Immunities Clause and the Due Process Clause, or whether she just was putting on an act and acting like she didn't know. And then Senator Hatch was being sort of gentlemanly and said, oh, I know you're under a lot of pressure.
Let me ask you, baffling. Yeah, going back to her resume, I mean, all the way back to summa cum laude at Princeton, the intellectual firepower gets brought up by critics sometimes, but I mean, how do you square it with her kind of totally stellar academic record?
I'm saying I'm baffled that given that she seems to have good credentials, that she would do this in opinions, and then that she would, when questioned yesterday, appear not to even understand what was being asked, and that her failure to grapple with the important precedents and opinions, to try to ditch a case and sweep it under the rug without even writing an opinion about it.
Stephen Carter, what do you say to this line of criticism?
I've heard that argument before. I'm a little bit troubled by it. First, as to Judge Sotomayor's opinions, there's a number of extremely difficult and complex cases with enormous implications, many of them involving business, taxes, the EPA. It could go through a long list, intellectual property, a field in which I teach, in which she's written stellar opinions on enormously complex questions, far more complex, I might add, than any of the constitutional law questions that underlie what Wendy was just talking about. We tend to refer to constitutional law cases as difficult, but they're not nearly as difficult, I think, as – they're just more controversial, not nearly as difficult as a lot of the very tough business cases that are the bread and butter work of the Second Circuit. And these are highly controversial cases, many of them within the fields in which I work and teach. Second, on the merits of, for example, one of Wendy's examples, I actually agree with Wendy that the Second Amendment should apply to the states and not just to the federal government. I agree with that as a matter of law. The Supreme Court ruled the other way. Now, that ruling was a long time ago. The court is likely to overturn it soon. But it's still the law, and other courts of appeals that have grappled with this question have come out the same way that Judge Sotomayor did. So certainly her view is the mainstream view in the law on the Second Amendment. I happen to disagree with it, but it is certainly the way the law is coming out everywhere else as well. So my point is that I think it's actually not viewed by most court of appeals judges as a terribly difficult question, although I do think it's a question on which the law currently is incorrect.
Let's get a call from Marilyn in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Marilyn. You're on the air.
Thank you. I must say, while I didn't watch all of the hearings, I did catch Senator Graham's, I thought, absolutely outrageous remarks questioning her temperament and whether she was too tough. I'm a lawyer who has often argued in the Second Circuit, and I have appeared before Judge Sotomayor, a panel over which she presided.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say that it was a pleasure, and I mean that, a pleasure to appear before her. She was extremely well prepared. She asked very incisive questions, and she was very good humored. Also, perhaps people don't realize what it is to argue in the Second Circuit. You're lucky if you get out your name and the clients you're representing, and they are on you with questions so fast and furious.
It is a hot bench. But what do you make then, Marilyn, of these comments that came from the Almanac of Federal Judiciary? These are from attorneys, perhaps like yourself. This is what Senator Graham quoted, a terror on the bench, overly aggressive, out-of-control manner. What do you make of that, Marilyn? You've been there.
Well, I don't know. These were anonymous remarks. I don't know where they came from. I'm sure there were remarks that complimented her demeanor on the court that weren't read, but my experience was very, very different with her.
We've got it, and we appreciate your witness on that front. Let me get one more call, and then we'll turn exactly to that. David in Troy, Alabama. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'd just like to make the comment. With Judge Sotomayor making the comment about a wise Latina, I don't have a problem with, but my problem is that if I was to say something like that, being a white male, that I would be basically burned at the stake. And I'd like to hear y'all's comments about that.
We'll pick it up. Stephen Carter, first to you on temperament, and here it comes again. Where is fairness on asserting the wisdom of a particular color or ethnicity?
Well, I was hoping we were actually done with the wise Latina comment, but I guess people will remember that forever. It's one of the risks often of opening your mouth. The thing is, there's not a lot of data to suggest that the speeches that Supreme Court justices give have much influence on their decision-making. The data, again, are the other way. The best predictor of what someone's going to do on the bench is what they did, what they're going to do in the high court is what they did before they got on the court, and I really think that's where our focus should be. I think we shouldn't assume that somehow that these people are nominated to the Supreme Court have these secret agendas that they then publicly announce mysteriously at odd occasions and then hide for years and years and years in their opinions on the courts of appeals. I just don't think that's a plausible view of how people are.
By temperament or substance, how do you think she might inflect the court, the high court, the Supreme Court?
I will tell you one thing about her temperament that I'm really very hopeful about. One of the really depressing things about the court today, and I suspect that Wendy Long would agree with this, is how much sniping the justices do at each other in their footnotes and their opinions. There was another era like this. There was a brief era like this in the late 50s, and then it settled down. The 50s, 60s, 70s, the court wasn't like that. They didn't always agree, but the disagreements were very respectful. Now a lot of times the opinions, they're not. What you see in her opinions when she's on a divided court is generally a lot of respect for those with whom she's in disagreement. She also tends to have that respect at a personal level. She doesn't see herself on a mission. I've never known her as someone who finds that people who disagree with her have to be fools or crazy or dangerous. She always likes to engage with people with whom she disagrees. And it's my hope that one thing that she will bring to the court, whatever else one may think of her jurisprudence or anything else, is a kind of civility, a kind of example of how you can disagree thoughtfully and maybe stop all the sniping back and forth in the footnotes. I'm very hopeful about that, and I think that would be a wonderful thing for the court, because I think the court right now is fractured in ways that are often bad for its opinions and bad for its dignity.
Wendy Long, we'll have to hear more, but in a word, any doubt in your mind at this point that she's coming on to the Supreme Court?
Oh, I don't know. I don't want to predict the outcome. I don't think that's necessarily what we should do at this point.
Fair enough, but we've heard a lot today, and we appreciate each of you being here to help us look at the nomination. Wendy Long with the Judicial Confirmation Network joining us from Washington. Thank you so much, Wendy.
Thank you.
And Stephen Carter, author of the new novel Jericho's Fall, professor at Yale Law School, joining us from New Haven, Connecticut. Professor Carter, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Wendy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.